Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, coming back. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. This is Ken Hensley sitting in for Patrick. And we've got Kip on the line. I wanted to finish our conversation quickly, Kip. I came up with an analogy, I guess, that I think would explain what I'm trying to say here. The United States is a country. Now, we may be very divided on many things, and we are, but we are one country. And one country, therefore, we have a Supreme Court, we have a Congress, we can deal with issues that arise within our country. But we don't have any authority, as it were, to rule on what's happening in England or France or Switzerland or Bulgaria. We just don't have the authority to do that. And in a similar way, the church in the early centuries was functioning as one church expanding and filling the Roman world. In fact, there's a beautiful quotation from Irenaeus, and I can't find it right now, but there's a beautiful quotation where he's writing around 180 in the 180s AD, in which he talks about the oneness of the church, and he says, even though the church is spread throughout the world at that time, the Roman world, it speaks with one voice. He says, the church speaks as though it had one heart and as though it spoke from one mouth. And he says, those in Germany don't believe anything different than those in Africa or Syria, Jerusalem, France. So there was one church forming. And as you had one church and you had all of these, and you had bishops in all of the major churches, well, they could meet together and they could fight off heresies that were arising within the church. But once the church shattered at the time of the Reformation, into separate churches, that's just not possible anymore. You understand, Kip?
Yeah, I'm having trouble figuring out the difference between somebody spinning off from the Catholic Church in the Reformation and the Arian heresy spinning off from the Catholic Church in the ancient times. I'm just not as educated. Perhaps that's my roadblock, but I'm just having a hard time seeing the difference.
Well, I guess the analogy I've given, just ponder that analogy then, because what I'm saying is that the church then could deal with an internal heresy and could shut that heresy out. Once the Reformation occurred, and entire countries broke off and became Lutheran, Anglican, Reformed, there were wars between these countries now. So the Catholic world is at war with the Protestant world in many places. And the church now just doesn't have any authority. I mean, the church can say, you know, you Reformed Baptist, in England are wrong, but the church has no authority. The church only has authority within its own realm. Thanks a lot for calling Kip, and thanks for your question. What I want to do here is we head into our second hour, and the number here is 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149 if you'd like to be on the show. Is I want to remind everyone that today is the March for Life. Today, January 20th, this is something I've been given to read, marks an historic day for the pro-life movement. It's the first March for Life since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, which sent abortion legislation back to the states. In celebration of this victory and continued efforts to protect all human life in every state, join the March for Life in spirit with hashtag Fast for Life. That's one word, Fast for Life. Take an active part in the march from your home or office by praying and fasting, uniting your prayers with the March Pilgrims for the protection of the unborn and their families. Sign up to pray in solidarity at relevantradio.com/fast and receive our free downloadable booklet, The Choice is Love, to equip yourself with compassionate and truth-filled answers to the most pressing abortion questions. Join in prayer and fasting as we witness the making of history today with hashtag Fast for Life at relevantradio.com/fast today.
Hey, Ken, yesterday we passed over 500 million memoraries praying for an end to abortion. That's half a billion prayers to end abortion here at Relevant Radio. So that's reason to celebrate right there.
That's amazing. Am I getting that number right? You're saying half a billion?
Half a billion prayers to end abortion. And today we're closing on 4,000 signups for this hashtag Fast for Life. So it's still not too late to participate. So just go to relevantradio.com, look for the hashtag Fast for Life banners. It's super simple, and you can join us. And we have people all over the world that have joined. We have Dawn in Phoenix, Arizona. She's fasting mm-hmm. for 24 hours, praying the rosary with Father Rocky tonight. We have Ben. I like this one. Ben from Dayton, Ohio. In addition to the traditional food fast, I've learned from Exodus 90 that cold showers make for an excellent fast. And I think he means those are fast showers. You don't stay in a cold shower for too long. And we have Esther in Hawaii and Sister Virginia in Chicago and David in Maryland and Minnesota. Just thousands of names here, people praying for an end to abortion.
That is quite amazing, actually, to hear those numbers. And I understand, if I understand correctly, you're only responsible personally for about 100,000 of those memoraries. Isn't that right?
That I might be closing in somewhere around that number, yeah.
Listen, here's an article. I want to read part of this for everyone, too, because this kind of stuns me, really. I think that given the fact that the mainstream media in our country, in basically every form, is not pro-life, and therefore it does not convey good news regarding life. It is always sort of pumping the other direction. This article that I picked up here, this is from the dailysignal.com, and this is an article that came out yesterday. Listen to what it says. The majority of Americans support protecting the unborn. That's the title. Almost 70% of Americans support limiting abortion to the first 3 months of pregnancy, a survey by the Knights of Columbus Marist poll released Wednesday revealed. Almost 70% of Americans, 60% of the survey's respondents, said that they oppose using tax dollars for abortion services domestically, while 78% oppose funding abortion services abroad. Those numbers are still too low in my estimation. It's amazing to me that only 60% would oppose using tax dollars on an issue in which, on a moral issue in which our country is so powerfully divided. It's amazing that only 60% would want to oppose using tax dollars, which means 40% just basically say, who cares what you think? We want abortion and we want tax dollars used to fund it. Continuing with the article, nearly 7 in 10 Americans believe abortion should be limited, Marist poll director Barbara L. Carvalho said in a news release, and then again quoting her, after a year of contentious public debate over the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, the results are comparable to the findings of a Knights of Columbus Marist poll conducted last January. The poll, which demonstrates widespread support for pro-life legislation, comes 2 days before the 50th annual March for Life, which is taking place today, in which pro-lifers will march to the U.S. Capitol to celebrate the end of Roe versus Wade and urge states to pass laws protecting the unborn. And we need to pray for them. Who knows? I'm not able to look at the news right now, but who knows what kind of backlash they may be receiving in their march today. As you know, since the time when Roe versus Wade was overturned, there have been attacks on many, many, many Catholic churches, mainly Catholic churches, but Christian churches. There have been attacks on the churches, on pregnancy help centers. And so who knows what's happening today? I'm going to be interested to look that up. The poll, which demonstrates widespread support for pro-life legislation, comes 2 days before the 50th annual March for Life, in which pro-lifers will march to the U.S. Capitol to celebrate the end of Roe v. Wade and urge states to pass laws protecting the unborn. More than 90% of respondents said they support pregnancy resource centers, a target of Democratic condemnation in the last year, according to the poll. Last week, more than 200 House Democrats voted against denouncing the attacks on pro-life pregnancy centers since the leak of the draft opinion indicating the overturning of Roe versus Wade. And I remember hearing Patrick talk about this the other day, this fact that a proposal was put forward simply to condemn the attacks, and the Democrats in the House, more than 200 House Democrats voted against denouncing the attacks. Of course, their reasoning, the argument that they put forward, was that they wanted to also condemn attacks on abortion clinics and whatnot. They wanted it to be what they would consider fair and balanced, and so that's why they voted against it. But it's interesting that you can't make just a simple statement about something that is actually happening and happening quite a bit and condemn it. They were not able to bring themselves to do that. Reading on from the article, since the start of the Knights of Columbus Marist poll in 2008, we've seen a consistent and clear consensus of Americans who support restrictions on abortion, Knights of Columbus Supreme Knight Patrick Kelly said in a news release. Likewise, an overwhelming majority of people, 90% this year, believe that our laws can protect both the mother and the unborn child. Too often, the abortion debate is framed in the context of supporting either one or the other, Kelly added. The reality is, we can and must craft laws that protect both mothers and their children. A little bit more of this. Almost 80% of Americans surveyed said the law should not require doctors, nurses, or other healthcare professionals with religious objections to abortions, should not require them, should not force them to perform abortions. Additionally, 60% of Americans said they oppose abortion for children with Down syndrome. Democrats claim most Americans support abortion rights, touting unclear polls from groups like Monmouth and NPR. Yet a closer look at the Monmouth results reveals that 54% of Americans oppose a national law codifying Roe, while only 46% want Congress to pass a national law. 54% oppose having a national law codifying Roe versus Wade. I wish the number were much higher than that, but it is more than 50%. Kelly said the Knights hope to increase their support for mothers and unborn children. Final quotation, the Knights will redouble our efforts to restore a culture of life and advance a culture of compassion for pregnant women in need. And the upshot of this article is simply to say that the idea that is floated so continually that the United States is pro-choice and that the vast majority of people want abortion is just very imprecise. It's not really the whole truth. And when you dig down into asking more specific questions, you find that that's not really the case. If you want to be on the show today, the number is 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. I want to take an email here. This comes from Tina in San Diego, listening on 1000 AM KCEO. And she writes, my daughter's boyfriend is a non-denominational Christian. When my daughter has shown him Catholic resources to prove the Catholic Church is the church Jesus founded, he says he needs a non-biased source. He feeds from any internet source he can find. Honestly, I don't think he practices his faith. He almost seems like an atheist at times. What non-Catholic source can we provide so it is not biased? The reason I'm curious about this question, or not curious, the reason I'm interested in this question is because I think it gives an opportunity to bring out an important point. What your daughter's boyfriend probably means when he says, can you give me a non-biased source, is that he wants a non-Catholic source. But here's the question, what non-Catholic source is going to make the case for the Catholic Church? If what you want him to study or to be exposed to is the case for the truth of Catholicism that the Church Christ established is the Catholic Church, then obviously he's going to need to read sources that are arguing that case, that are making that case. I mean, think about it. If you wanted to, make the case for God's existence, you're not going to read atheist sources. You're not going to think, well, you know, I want to have an unbiased source, so I want to read an atheist making the case for God's existence. Obviously, the person making the case for God's existence is going to be someone who believes in God's existence. And so I think that if I were speaking to your daughter's boyfriend, the first thing I'd want to try and emphasize is to him is, hey, look, ultimately, there is no unbiased sources, meaning that every one of us has a point of view. Everyone comes at subjects with a point of view, and that's true on both sides. If you read a Catholic source making the case for Catholicism, well, they obviously are not unbiased in the sense that they believe in the truth of Catholicism, and they're making the case. And if you read someone who's not a Catholic making the case against Catholicism, well, you're not reading someone who is unbiased. Again, you're reading someone who has their own bias. Everyone has a point of view. Everyone approaches a subject like this wearing eyeglasses of one color or another. There is no neutrality in that sense. And so I would want to try and communicate that to him. And then I would want to say, probably what you mean is that you want scholarly sources presented to you. I mean, I can't give you a source. I can't give you a non-Catholic source that's going to make the greatest case for Catholicism. But I can lead you toward scholarly sources. And so one scholarly source that I could recommend to you, or several, would be a book, first of all, titled Evangelical Is Not Enough. This is one of the first books that I read, and it was a fantastic book. It's written by Tom Howard. At the time that Tom Howard wrote the book, he was Anglican. He wasn't Catholic. But the book is very good. Evangelical Is Not Enough makes a great case against basic non-denominational evangelical Christianity. Another great source would be J.N.D. Kelly's book that I referred to a lot on Wednesday, titled Early Christian Doctrines. J.N.D. Kelly, again, a world-class historian, extremely scholarly in his approach and in his material and what he witnesses to. And he, again, was not a Catholic. He was an Anglican. And so maybe that would be considered at least a little less biased. But his book, Early Christian Doctrines, clearly presents a church that just doesn't match up with, again, non-denominational evangelicalism. And another book by a historian, Yaroslav Pelikan, P-E-L-I-K-A-N, if you look it up on Amazon or wherever you're going to buy a book, Yaroslav Pelikan, his book's called The Emergence of the Catholic Tradition. The Emergence of the Catholic Tradition. He was a Lutheran historian at the time that he wrote this, a professor of ecclesiastical history at Yale University, who later then became Eastern Orthodox. So again, that might appear to your daughter's boyfriend as a more unbiased source. And I would recommend that you send him to those. Okay, we are going to, I really wanted today to get into the third subject I had on my list, and that is to talk about how I came to abandon the Reformation doctrine of sola fide, justification by faith alone. And I hope I can get to it, but there are a lot of things to do. So let's take a short break, and on the other side, we'll pick up from there. 888-914-9149 if you'd like to be on the show. That's 888-914-9149.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code PATRICK for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find out more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show. And if you'd like to be on the show, the number here is 888-914-9149. I recall this band. Aren't they the ones that are sort of like robots?
I don't know.
I mean, they have the affect of robots in some kind of a strange sense, if I remember right. They kind of sound robotic. The song sounds a little bit like a robot song, doesn't it?
I think it's the number. I think you're offending every Irish person, as this is the most listened to Irish song of all time, and I'm probably wrong, and someone's going to correct me on that. But I think they're Irish, and I think it's the most listened to song.
No, okay. Let me backpedal slightly then by saying I just mean that the song is very clipped. It's got the doom doom doom, you know, very very sharp, and so it has a bit of the affect of robotic. I'm sorry to say
in
that
in a
now.
Good way.
Do not kill me. Do not kill me. I love Ireland. I mean, Ireland is like my favorite place on earth. Well, listen.
I got you sweating. I like it.
Sweating spinal fluid, as they say, when it becomes really difficult. Okay, what I have wanted to do and what I said I was going to do this week was talk about three of the most important themes or ideas that in the end convinced me that I needed to resign my ministry as a Baptist pastor, which I did back in a long time ago now, 1996, and to enter into full communion with the Catholic Church. The first of those issues I dealt with this past Monday and focused on the issue of sola scriptura, referred to as the formal principle of the Reformation. On Wednesday, I focused on a second issue, and that is what happened when I became exposed in a deep way to the early church fathers, and I read the early writings of the fathers, the earliest saints, the martyrs, the bishops, those who were closest to the apostles, and just I realized that the kind of church they were describing sounded a whole lot more like the Catholic Church than it did my non-denominational, you know, congregational church that went by the name of Baptist. And so today I want to talk about the other major issue of the Reformation, that is justification by faith alone. Now, this is a subject that I brought up the very first time I covered for Patrick's show back in November. And I was feeling like, it just barely got started. I didn't make it all the way through. And so today I wanted to. And yet we've had so much to do with phone calls and other things today that I don't think I'm going to make it through again. But let me begin. I tried to organize this as seven steps. The seven steps, in other words, I'm not presenting a proof. I'm not proselytizing in the sense of trying to beat anybody over the head and prove that the Catholic view of salvation is true and that the Reformation doctrine of justification by faith alone is false. I'm telling my story. I'm explaining the steps by which I made that move. And I already know that I'm not going to make it through the steps again. So I'll have to continue the next time I cover for Patrick's show, if he wants me to do it anymore after this week. We'll have to find out when he gets back from his cruise, whether he gives me the thumbs up or the thumbs down. But that's what I want to talk about today and launch into it if I can. But if you'd like to be on the show, I'll keep my eye on the calls. And the number here is 888-914-9149. Now, what is then the Reformation doctrine of justification? I have to begin by defining that a little bit. And I'll try to do it in a brief way. The doctrine that came out of the Reformation through Luther, through his disciple Melanchthon, and then spreading on to Calvin, Bucer, Zwingli, and the other reformers, the doctrine that came out that is the classical Reformation doctrine says this: justification by faith alone, sola fide, at the moment one looks to Christ in faith, Christ's perfect righteousness is legally credited to that person's account, if you will, account with God. Christ's righteousness is legally credited, imputed. It's the doctrine of imputation, imputed to that person, and that person from that instant is justified in the sight of God. That person is saved, past tense. That person will certainly be in heaven. Now, that person is called to follow Christ and obey Christ, and there will be the pursuit of holiness in that person's life. But from the moment of faith alone, Justification has taken place. This legal transfer of Christ's righteousness has occurred, and that person is justified. Okay, that's the doctrine. Now, why is it important that one would hold such a view? Of course, Reformed and Reformation-minded theologians would say, well, because it's the teaching of the New Testament. This is the teaching of St. Paul. But there's more to it than that. Why is this conception of justification viewed as being critical? Just critical, something that must be held. It's because in order to be by grace alone, it is believed, justification must be by faith alone. Justification must be, the consistent Reformed theologian would say, or Christian would say, it must be by faith alone in order to preserve it being by grace alone. Now, this is something that goes to the very heart of the Reformation understanding of justification by faith alone. While obedience is viewed as something that ought to naturally follow in the life of a Christian who has been regenerated, given the gift of the Holy Spirit at the moment of justification, obedience must never be considered a condition for one's salvation or a requirement for one's salvation, for one's justification. After all, this is how it would go. This is how the logic would go. If our obedience is to any degree required in order for us to be saved, justified, enter eternal life, then salvation would be something we have earned. Then that makes salvation something that we have participated in, and at least in part, earned for ourselves. This would make salvation something in which we can boast, something for which God will not receive all the glory. This is an important line of thought, and it's very simple. Put it together in your head. The idea is simply this. We want Christ to receive all the glory for the work of salvation. We want to view salvation as purely, simply, in an unmixed fashion, the work of God's grace. We want it to be such that there's nothing in which we could ever boast in. And the only way to accomplish that is to say that justification occurs by the legal imputation of Christ's righteousness to the account of the one who believes. So that from the second I looked up at the cross of Christ, it was a done deal. Now, because of this, Luther described justification by faith alone as the article upon which the church stands or falls. He basically said, this is the key thing. If you don't accept this view of justification, the church collapses. The church becomes a damning system of works righteousness. You've got all these people that's earning their way to heaven and boasting for all eternity. It's an abomination. Therefore, justification by faith alone is the article or the doctrine, the teaching upon which the church stands or falls. And because of this, Luther was willing to consign, for instance, the Epistle of James in the New Testament to the flames, because James says that a man is not justified by faith alone. In fact, it's the only place in the New Testament where the words faith and alone occur together. And it's in a context where James is saying we're not justified by faith alone, but also by our deeds, our obedience. Here's what Luther said about this. Away with James. Its authority is not great enough to cause me to abandon the doctrine of faith. If they, he's referring now to other teachers, if they will not agree to my interpretations, then I shall make rubble of it. I almost feel like throwing Jimmy into the stove. It is flatly against St. Paul and all the rest of Scripture in ascribing justification to works. Therefore, I do not want him in my Bible. Now, of course, Luther reversed, you know, Luther was prone to making very, very bold and over-the-top and emotional statements. And he backtracked on that later on, and James was included in his translation of the New Testament. But this is how he felt at the time. I mean, think about it. He reads James saying, a man is not justified by faith alone, but by his deeds as well. And his response is to think, this is so contradictory to what I see in St. Paul. So contradictory to my view of the doctrine of salvation and justification that I almost feel like taking this epistle of James and throwing it into the stove. He called it an epistle of straw in another context. I almost feel like burning this thing up because it's flatly against St. Paul. So because of this, Luther had this very strong view. It's the article upon which the church stands or falls. John Calvin used a different analogy. He referred to justification by faith alone as, quote, the hinge upon which the door of all true religion swings. And to this day, Protestants, I mean, especially those of a more reformed tradition, not all Protestants fit into any camp. You know, there's so many views, and so it's impossible to say the Protestant view. But I would say the classic Reformation view and the view that is held by classical Protestants of the more reformed traditions. And really, if you were to probe down, basically every evangelical in America holds this view of justification. They may not self-consciously be describing it in as many words as I am, but this is the view that they hold. And to this day, Protestants have a hard time conceiving how anyone could be a true Christian and reject this doctrine of justification by faith alone, sola fide. In fact, I mentioned when I was on the show back in November that in a book that I have on this subject that is written by a number of Protestant theologians, Dr. John Gerstner, who had been one of Scott Hahn's professors at Gordon-Conwell Seminary, he writes in his article, his contribution to this book, which is called Justification by Faith Alone, the book. He confesses that he, quote, mourned for Scott when he heard that Scott had become Catholic. And when you read on and you ask yourself, why is he mourning? I mean, why is he's mourning. He explains, he's mourning for Scott because he believes that no one who had truly understood the doctrine of justification by faith alone and then rejected it could be a true Christian. So the fact that Scott had left this Reformation view and become Catholic and accepted a view where faith and obedience are both required as part of the path to heaven. His conception now is that Scott Hahn is proving by this that he never was a true Christian. He must have never really known Christ, is what Dr. Gerstner is thinking. And therefore he mourned. Well, to this day, this is basically how the most serious Reformation-minded, I refer to them, Protestants think about the issue. If you hold to justification by faith alone, you're holding to the gospel. And if you depart from that and you embrace the Catholic teaching that by the grace of God alone, we cooperate with God's grace, and we respond with faith and the obedience that flows from humble faith, and we walk a path of perseverance and faith and obedience to finally enter heaven. In their minds, what we have embraced, what Catholics embrace and what the Catholic Church teaches, is a damning system of works righteousness. That's how one prominent Reformed pastor has referred to it. It's a damning system of works righteousness. Now, there is so much biblical material that deals with salvation, obviously. I mean, basically the whole Bible. There'll be passages in every chapter of the Bible that would have to be brought in to do an absolutely thorough job. There's no way I can make a full case in the time that we have. And so what I'm going to do is simply relate in seven steps the story of how I came, personally, to abandon the doctrine of justification by faith alone in the imputed righteousness of Christ, legally credited righteousness of Christ, and to embrace this view that every Christian I knew thought of as a damning system of works righteousness. How did that come about? How did it come about in my life? That's what I want to talk about today. And I do want you to hold on, those of you that are on the phone, Joanne and Dale, I will get to your calls on the other side of the break. I want to give you the number again. Anyone that would like to be a part of this conversation, please give me a call at 888-914-9149, and I will attempt to do what Patrick does every day.
Thank you.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
All right. Well, it's good to be back with you. This is Ken Hensley sitting in for the very great Patrick Madrid on the Patrick Madrid Show. If you'd like to be a part of the show today, the number to call is 888-914-9149. I want to pick up where I was in my discussion, but let's quickly go, first of all, to Dale calling in from Lakeville, Minnesota. Dale, you're on the Patrick Madrid Show.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to respond to the caller that was looking for a non-biased argument for the Catholic Church. Now, this isn't a scholarly source, but it's fun. I know with iPhones, if you ask Siri who created the Lutheran Church, you'll get Martin Luther. And if you ask other denominations, you know, you'll get John Knox and Wesley and so on. And then if you ask who created the Catholic Church, you'll get the answer, Jesus Christ created the Catholic
Church. Hey, let's test it. Hey, Siri, who created the Catholic Church?
Jesus Christ created Catholic Church.
There you go.
Dale, I have to keep myself from breaking out laughing. Your response is brilliant. Yeah, I'm not sure if that's the source that that many would take as being authoritative, but that's a really interesting little point. That's a really interesting point. And Dale, thanks for calling in with that, all right?
Thanks for taking my call.
Okay, have a good day. Let's go to Joanne calling from Napa, California. How are you doing, Joanne?
Hi, thanks, Ken. Appreciate it. I was raised Catholic, and my parents brought me to the Institute and Basic Life Principles. And from there, I started memorizing and meditating on large portions of Scripture using the Greek and Hebrew concordance. And I wanted to start the practice again. And I was wondering if you could recommend a Catholic study Bible for me.
Well, I can partially. I love the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible of the New Testament. This is a one volume covering the New Testament, edited by Scott Hahn. And I wish I could reach it. It's across the room from me, but I do not know how to walk across the room with these headphones I'm wearing. So it's called the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible. It's a very good New Testament with extensive notes. It's a great leaping off point for doing study. And of course, then, if you're really doing intensive study, you're going to be looking into individual critical commentaries on various books of the Bible. Now, I know they have begun the Old Testament as well, and there are certain books of the Old Testament that they've done, but they haven't completed the Old Testament, so there is no Ignatius Study Bible covering the whole Old Testament. But if you pick up the New Testament and you begin to read it and read the notes, it'll lead you to many other great resources as well. So that's what I'd recommend, Joanne. That's the best Catholic Study Bible. You're welcome.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling in. Thanks for being on the show today. Okay, I'm going to continue now with what I was talking about, the seven steps by which I was led away from the Reformation doctrine of sola scriptura. The first step for me was this. The first step was simply noticing something. This is like a wrench that just got tossed into the works, okay? It was noticing that in the stories of the Old Testament, men and women of God, obedience is always presented as a condition for them receiving God's promised blessing. And never is this presented as a problem, as something that somehow destroys the gracious nature of the blessing being given. Let me repeat that again and elaborate. It was just coming to realize, simply noticing something that is this patently obvious if you read the Old Testament, and that is you have men and women of God and their relationships with God, and in their relationship, obedience was always presented as a condition, that is, as something they had to do in order to receive the blessing that is given to them, this promise by God. And never is this presented as a problem. Now, this began in my life. I mean, this little wrench was thrown in actually all the way back in seminary. So after seminary, I was ordained and I was a Baptist pastor for 11 years. And yet this occurred way back in seminary and got me thinking. But it was a thinking that would not come to full fruition until I started studying the Catholic faith many years later. But that's how it started. And this occurred while I was still in seminary. I remember one of my New Testament professors came in, was standing in class one day, and he was talking about Martin Luther and John Calvin. He was talking about the Reformation doctrine of sola fide. And he made this comment that was, it was almost offhanded. He said, you know, it's interesting, though. He said, if you read the Old Testament, the Old Testament amounts to really nothing more than the stories of men and women and their relationships with God. That's the whole thing. And he said, in every one of those stories, faith and obedience are required. They are presented as conditions for receiving the blessing of God. And never is this presented as somehow like legalism or something bad. You know, never is this presented as, oh man, now they're involved in a damning system of works. Oh, now they're going to be able to boast forever if they have to obey God in order to receive his blessings. I remember he went on to give illustrations. He mentioned Noah. He said Noah had to trust God when God came to him warning of the flood. And he had to build the ark, obedience to God, in order to be saved through the flood. There was no salvation by faith alone. Noah had to trust God, and he had to follow through and build the ark in order to be saved. And I remember he pointed out, faith, of course, was at the heart of Noah's obedience. We're not saying that faith is not even primary, meaning the essence of things, at the heart of things, because if Noah hadn't believed God, the warning that God gave him, if Noah hadn't trusted in God, he wouldn't have built an ark. So faith was at the core, but he also had to build the ark. He had to trust God and build the ark. As James might have put it, his faith was working with his obedience, or his obedience was working with his faith, and by his obedience, his faith was perfected. That's what James says in James chapter 2. My professor went on to say, you know, it's the same with Abraham. In Genesis 12, we read, now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you I will curse, and by you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. God comes to Abram and makes these great promises, commanding him to go from his country and to follow him, and all these wonderful things are going to happen. And the next thing we read is, so Abraham went, as the Lord had told him. Again, we find Abraham needing to trust God. Faith is at the heart of it. But he also has to obey. He also has to leave Ur of the Chaldees, and he has to follow, or he's not going to inherit the land. He's not going to inherit the promises. They're not going to be fulfilled in his life. So what was required in order to receive the promise was faith and the obedience that would naturally flow from his faith. In fact, years after, this is Genesis chapter 22, when Abraham was famously commanded to offer his son Isaac as a sacrifice on Mount Moriah. Well, you all know the story. Abraham obeys. The angel of the Lord intervenes to stop him from sacrificing his son. And listen to what the Lord says to him. By myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this, and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will indeed bless you, and I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and as the sand which is on the seashore. And by your descendants all the nations of the earth will be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. And the thing that's critical here, the thing that struck me, is that the Lord repeats the very promises here that were made back in Genesis chapter 12. He repeats the same promises. And he explicitly says that he is going to fulfill these promises because of Abraham's obedience. So, is it Abraham's faith that wins the fulfillment of the promises, or is it Abraham's obedience? And you can't answer the question because it's both. He has to trust God, and he has to follow God, and he has to follow through with obedience to God in order to receive the promises. Now, Abraham is described in the New Testament as being the very father of faith. Abraham is the prime example that St. Paul brings forward for us as the father of faith, someone who walked with God in faith and received the promises. And yet, when Abraham's life is summarized, and the final reason is given as to why God is going to keep his covenant with Abraham and bless his descendants and make them like the stars of heaven, what is the focus? I'm reading here from Genesis chapter 26, verse 5, where God comes to Isaac after the death of Abraham and confirms his covenant with Isaac because of Abraham. And this is what he says, "I will be with you and I will bless you because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." He even becomes specific. In other words, the story of Abraham takes us from Genesis 12 to Genesis 26, Abraham's life. He's the father of faith. He's the great example of someone who trusted God and received the promises from God. God made his covenant with Abraham. And yet, when his life is summarized here, when the final reason is given for why God is going to keep his covenant with Abraham and bless him and make his descendants like the stars of heaven, the focus doesn't end up being on his faith, but on his obedience. And in spades, because it says, "Sojourn in the land," he said to Isaac, "I will be with you and I will bless you because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." Now, obviously, Abraham didn't perfectly obey God. He failed many times. He sinned again and again. But still, in his halting way, he trusted God. In his stumbling, halting way, he did obey God. And God, looking down at him with eyes of infinite mercy, is willing to say, "Abraham obeyed my voice. He kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." My professor went on to talk about the example of Moses and the Israelites, and he said, we see the same thing. Moses and the Israelites, they have to trust God's word to them, and they have to prepare the Passover. They have to sacrifice it, they have to eat it, and they have to walk out of Egypt, and they have to cross the Red Sea. That is, in order to inherit the promised land, the land of Canaan, the land flowing with milk and honey. They have to trust God and cross the Red Sea and follow the pillar of cloud by day and fire by night and make their way for 40 years through the wilderness and eat the manna that came down every day and on and on and on. It's always faith and obedience. My professor pointed out that in these Old Testament stories, obedience is always a condition for receiving the promised blessing. And here's really what hit me. Never is there a hint that somehow this is destroying the graciousness of God's blessing, or this is leading to boasting, or that this amounts to these men and women having earned God's blessing. This is nowhere in the page. This is nowhere in the story. And if you were to say, well, does this mean, I mean, since Noah had to build an ark in order to be saved through the flood, does this mean that Noah's up in heaven boasting for all eternity? You know, Noah's beating on his chest and saying, "God did his part, but I did mine. I earned my salvation by building the ark." And is Abraham up in heaven bragging and bragging and saying, "Well, God, it would be nice if you received all the glory for the promises that have been fulfilled by our covenant, but actually, you have to take into account that I did quite a bit. I mean, I'm the one who left Ur of the Chaldees, not you. I'm the one who left my family and kinsmen and traveled to the land of promise, not you. And therefore, God, you get some of the glory, but I also get some of the glory." This is what originally got me thinking. This is step one. This is what originally got me thinking that maybe there was something wrong with this, with the paradigm that I had learned and that I had been used to thinking within. You know, this paradigm that said, unless justification is by faith alone, so that the instant you believe in Christ, his righteousness is credited to you, and you are saved from that moment, that unless this is what we believe, I mean, if obedience has anything whatsoever to any degree, that if obedience is viewed as a requirement to any degree, as a condition for being saved, then the gospel has been turned upside down and destroyed. Now God won't receive all the glory. Now we will be able to boast for all eternity that we had earned our own salvation. This is the first thing, and it was just a simple observation that my professor made that I began to chew on. It was this observation that was the first thing that got me thinking, is there something wrong with this paradigm? Because I certainly don't see it in all these stories through the Old Testament. Not at all. This led me to step two. And I'll simply state step two, and then we'll come back to it on the other side of the break. We're coming close to. Step two was this. Coming to see that this Old Testament pattern, it was not reversed in the New Testament. Instead, it continues right on through from Matthew to Revelation. Obedience continues to be presented in the New Testament again and again and again as though it were a requirement for entering paradise. And again, without a hint of concern that this somehow compromises grace. And I'm sure many of you are thinking, what the heck are you talking about? We'll come back on the other side. The number here to call in is 888-914-9149 if you'd like to be on the show.